Well, the month of September is just about done. And before it is over, I want to call to your memory the anniversaries of two separate deaths. The first is the tragic death of Princess Diana at the age of 36. And the other is the death by heart attack of Mother Teresa, who died just one day before Princess Diana's state funeral. So they died right together. And I mention these two anniversaries, call them to your memory, because they represent such contrasts. While much of the world was glued to their TVs for Diana's funeral, Mother Teresa's funeral was a quiet affair in the Catholic tradition, where prayers for God's mercy were said. And there was nothing in her funeral that recognized any special claim that she might have had for divine honor. While Diana laid in state in a royal chapel, Mother Teresa's body was laid in state on a block of ice to protect from rotting. The service for her reminded the participants that everyone is in need of God's grace. What a contrast. I think of these two funerals when I consider the contrast between entitlement and grace. Princess Diana was born into an aristocratic English family in 1961 and received the title Lady Diana when her father inherited the title Earl Spencer in 1975, when Diana was only 14 years old. A global audience of nearly 750 million people watched her wedding take place at St. Paul's Cathedral in July 1981. Once married to Prince Charles, she received more titles: Princess of Wales, Duchess of Cornwall, Duchess of Rothesay, Countess of Chester, and Baroness of Renfrew. It's a good thing she didn't have to put all of that on a business card. Mother Teresa, on the other hand, was born of Albanian parents in 1910. Her given name was Agnes. Her father was a construction worker who died when she was only 10 years old. She was raised by her devout mother, who instilled in young Agnes a deep compassion for the poor. "My child," she told Agnes, "never eat a single mouthful unless you are sharing it with others." Her mother would invite the poor into their home to eat. And one day, young Agnes said to her mother, "Who are all these people?" And her mother responded, "Some of them are our relations, but all of them are our people." Mother Teresa never grew to be more than 5 feet tall, and she had no titles. Mother Teresa would have loved this story Jesus told about the workers in the vineyard. Reading between the lines, I suspect that the writer of the Gospel of Matthew wanted to make sure that this story was in his account of the life of Jesus, because he was leading a church that was composed of two different types of people. First, there were those who were entitled, those who had a strong Jewish background. They knew all the stories that we call the Old Testament stories. They knew about Moses and Isaac and Jacob. They knew the whole series of stories that we read in the Old Testament. The men had all been circumcised, and both women and men in that group benefited from having instilled into them from childhood that they were part of God's chosen people. They felt privileged. They felt entitled. They were like royalty in the church. That was one group. But then there was another group in that early church who would have identified more with Mother Teresa. They were people who had grown up out of the orbit of the Jewish faith. They did not know the stories in what we call the Old Testament. They had never been through the rituals of circumcision, or they had never experienced a bar or a bat mitzvah. They had no conception of being God's chosen people. These are the two groups in the church, and we can hardly imagine how that early church melded these two groups into one. That is to say, how do we create a church out of Princess Diana aristocrats and Mother Teresa destitute? How do we make a church into one? It's in that context that I think this parable was used. Latecomers to the congregation, the Gentiles, were fully members of the church and deserved the same recognition as the Jewish members of the church. Those who had been working from the very beginning to establish the church in a hostile environment. Those who gave generously all those years to keep the church afloat. Those who sacrificed their time and efforts, taught the scriptures, led the worship, served on committees, visited the sick, supported the poor, washed the dishes, cleaned the floors, served communion, took out the garbage, passed the plates, paid the bills, sang in the choir, filled out visitors' cards, filled out report cards, served coffee in the service, and locked the doors when everybody had left. These people thought they deserved more than those upstart Gentiles who just came into the church. That, I think, is the way this story was used in the early church. And I suppose it does have relevance for today. But instead of wringing this text tighter to get a few more drops of meaning out of it, I propose that we step back and look at this story alongside that old, familiar, and ancient story about Jonah. There really is a parallel. The story of Jonah is a kind of parable that speaks about entitlement and grace. See, Jonah thought he was special. After all, he was called to be a prophet. He was educated, ordained, credentialed, certified, and validated by his denomination. He had a preaching robe. He was filled with a sense of importance. He had a sheaf of letters of recommendation. He had a 4.0 GPA, and he came from a long line of faithful preachers. Jonah was happy to receive the grace of God. In fact, he expected nothing less. He thought he was entitled. In fact, Jonah had decided that he would be the ideal pastor of that fine, well-to-do, large congregation of the church in Tarshish. But God apparently had other plans for Jonah. God called Jonah to a church in the poorest, most crime-ridden neighborhood of the city of Nineveh, a city renowned for its crime and corruption. That was a stinging blow to the likes of Jonah, who thought he was entitled. So instead of going to Nineveh, Jonah decided he would just take a trip to Tarshish and sort of show up at that church and announce to them that he was really the man for the job. That's when Jonah found himself in deep trouble. On the ship sailing to Tarshish, the storm blew up, the ship was in danger of sinking. So here we find that familiar account of Jonah being swallowed up by a great sea monster. Incidentally, the word whale is not found in the story of Jonah. It's clearly a parable, and it's never meant to be taken literally. Haven't you felt like Jonah? Haven't you ever felt swallowed up by developments beyond your control? But as I was saying, when Jonah found himself sinking and sliding down the gullet of a great sea monster, he started yelling, "Well, I suppose so. I called to the Lord out of my distress, and he answered me. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried." Now watch how he changes from third person to first person. "Out of the belly of Sheol I cried, and you heard my voice. The waters closed in over me, and the deep surrounded me. Weeds were wrapped around my head, yet you brought my life up out of the pit, O Lord my God. As my life was ebbing away, I remembered the Lord." I bet he did. Truth is, Jonah did not deserve such deliverance. He had been a jerk, and he proceeded to continue being a jerk. He went to the city of Nineveh and announced with glee its impending destruction. Then he waited outside the city limits to watch it be destroyed. But the destruction of Nineveh did not take place because the city repented, from the king all the way down to the poorest citizen. They all repented, and they received divine mercy. You know, there is nothing that can make religious people madder than the mercy of God. God seems to like people that some religious folk can't seem to stand. So we have before us two stories that end in precisely the same way. Jonah is peeved over God's mercy toward the people of Nineveh, and the full-time workers are peeved over the equal treatment of the part-time workers. And the truth is, we are secretly sympathetic with their anger. It doesn't seem fair. Both stories assault our sense of fairness. We may never understand God's logic, but we can understand some things like this. Whether you enter the life of faith sooner or later, whether you serve God from the first days of your youth into the strength of your midday, and serve God all the way to the end of your life, Or if you enter the life of faith as your day is dying in the West, you are equally precious to God. And to carry this one step further, there are those who are full of years, and when their work is done, they have finished their course. They're surrounded by children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. But then there are those young people who are taken from us long before the journey is even started. Long before they've achieved their potential, long before we are ready even to consider the possibility of their death. And from this parable, we get the assurance that both are equally welcomed by the divine. We learn something about the welcome of God. But there's more. We learn something about the amazing compassion of God. There's a tenderness to these stories. I don't know what other word to use. Tenderness. Jonah the Jerk was like Fred Phelps and members of the Westboro Baptist Church, loving the idea of the wrath of God. But God turned out to have compassion on Nineveh, just the way God had compassion on Jonah in his plight. But this was an affront to Jonah's sense of entitlement. How could God have compassion on the people of Nineveh? They didn't deserve it. And in the parable of Jesus, the owner of the vineyard keeps coming back to the town square to find more workers because he can't stand to see people out of work. There's a comparison here, a compassion for all of those out of work. We may not have an easy answer to the complex problem of joblessness in our day, but we can have compassion. We can vote for humane policies that show compassion and not condemnation for those who are out of work. And there's one more thing I want to mention. These stories picture an extraordinarily generous God. It's pure grace that saved Jonah. Nothing else, just grace. And it's pure grace that pays the workers a full day's wage. Nothing but grace. The bottom line is that the life God gives us is not payment for good work, but a gift that we don't deserve. Nothing but grace. In every other vineyard of this world, what really counts are political connections and status and degrees and titles and seniority. We strive to be in positions like chairperson or president or dean or doctor, tenured professor, the reverend doctor, whatever. But of all those titles, none of them are important in the life of faith. When you enter the world of faith in Christ, you enter a community of brothers and sisters, founded to help heal the wounds of the world. Let none of us begrudge the width of God's love. As the old gospel song says, the love of God is greater far than tongue or pen can ever tell. There is no pecking order, no ranking according to our church attendance or social or economic status, no title or birthright to give any one of us special privilege. The call of Christ is to all who labor and are heavy laden, and to all who received him, to them gave he power to become children of God.